take it back to monthly?
Well, you accuse me with your eyes. Like, I got into your computer one night in Wendaree and retyped.
Because how did that get back to monthly?
Because Microsoft did it. Bill Gates.
Okay.
His ghost.
That's very strange.
He's not dead, though.
But no, it's for this Steve Jobs who's dead.
What, did you do that on an Apple product?
No.
I'm so confused.
Okay.
Please, continue.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a bi-monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott. Sitting beside me is your co-host, Ian Mond.
That's me.
Hello, Ian.
Hi.
How are you?
Am I still too loud?
You're always too loud.
Okay, good.
But I think I've got the levels fine now.
That's great.
How was your 2014?
Yeah, well, what happened is I got pneumonia on Christmas.
I know. I saw that on Facebook.
Did you laugh?
No. Why would I laugh?
I don't know. Just chuckle. You know, was it Schadenfreude or what's the...
Schadenfreude.
Yeah, that one.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, I got pneumonia. I was in the hospital for 4 days. I was in the hospital over New Year's. Didn't really see the fireworks from where I was at the Alfred. But yeah, that was something
that's
I don't want to ever...
a sad story.
Yeah, that's something I don't want to ever relive again. I was actually, I was asleep as the thingy ticked over to 2015. I wasn't. I was woken up by the nurse. Not to wake me up for New Year's.
That would be awesome.
She was taking my obs. She was, you know, observations.
That would be awesome if she just came in to wake you up for New Year's. Yeah. It was part of their service. Don't want to miss the changeover.
Yeah.
And she had one of those little blowpipes that she could just...
And went...
the paper spiraled out.
No, but she did go off to have some non-alcoholic champagne.
Because she was on duty.
Correct. Excellent. She made a point of telling me that. And I don't know why I remembered it, because I was half gone. But, yeah, actually I was admitted into hospital New Year's Eve. So, yeah, I was pretty gone by that point. So I was, you know, coughing up phlegm, vomiting up phlegm.
Nice.
Breathing phlegm, eating phlegm.
Oh, you're not meant to, like, eat it.
Well, you just can't help but swallow it. There's not much of it in you. You just swallow it down.
Okay.
And my internal body was inflamed. Apparently I had sepsis because any time an organ...
Oh,
well,
wow.
Not in the sense of, you know, like someone who's gone out to deepest, darkest wherever and has picked up some sort of sepsis of the organs. I don't know where I was going with that. But apparently when you get pneumonia, if you hit a certain inflammatory level... Really? Is this interesting to anyone? If you hit a certain inflammatory level internally, it's considered to be sepsis. I don't know. That's what they told me.
I was just seeing how far you'd go with that.
With the deepest, darkest thing or the sepsis?
Everything.
Okay. Anyway, I'm better now.
Okay.
Right.
Well, I did not have pneumonia.
Oh, yeah. How was yours?
Oh, my 2014?
Yeah.
It was okay. It was busy and frantic, as 2015 is... likely to be as well, but that's okay.
You know, most people who do doctorates aren't frantic. They're quite relaxed. I know. I went through, saw people at my university. They seem very chilled about the whole thing.
That's lovely, Ian.
So what's your excuse? You're waking up at 6:30 in the morning? That's a very nice laugh.
You're funny.
Okay.
No, I'm not a morning person.
I know that.
I do, however, stay up fairly late.
Okay.
So I get my hours in, just not, you know, with the sun.
Well, look, good luck with the whole doctorate thing.
Thank you.
And I noticed that most people agreed with me about Station 11, which I think we'll just lend there, just except for Cheryl Morgan, who was in your court.
Ah, there we go. Well, see, the best people agree with me.
Okay, great.
It's a fine book, just, you know.
We don't have to go there again.
No,
I'm just
we
saying
don't.
That most people seem to agree with me and were quite upset by a lot of the things you said.
I didn't say any of this. Is this on Twitter?
No, I'm making quite okay, so, well, you wanted to do a rant about The Australian.
Oh, I just wanted to voice my extreme disapproval at the gross obituary of Colleen McCulloch that was published in The Australian last week.
Yeah.
So for anyone who hasn't heard, although there was a lovely Twitter hashtag which went around after that, the opening paragraph of Colleen McCulloch's obituary, who was, I think, The Thornbirds is still the highest selling Australian novel ever.
Yep.
So best-selling author.
Have you read The Thornbirds?
I've not read The Thornbirds. I remember watching the miniseries as a very young girl. I have read Tim. I did read Tim when I was in my teens.
Okay.
I remember liking it. I haven't read a lot of Colleen McCulloch. I don't think I have to have read Colleen McCulloch to be outraged.
But she...
By the fact that the Australian obituary opened with, she's plain of face.
But, before we get to the plain of face thing, I just wanted to note that she didn't get the tall poppy syndrome much as someone like Bryce Courtney did.
She wasn't as visible as Bryce Courtney.
Ah, okay.
She didn't do a lot of publicity and self-promotion. I mean, she did do interviews and things like that.
It might be because she was plain of face. That was probably the problem that she had. That was her. She didn't want to.
Plain of face and obviously overweight. Yes, so began the obituary to one of our best-selling and beloved writers.
Now, I asked you in the car on the way here, has the writer of this obituary apologised? And you, of course, responded with,
"Well,
it's a little bit more
according to reports, the obituary was based on a stock obituary that a lot of newspapers and news outlets keep. They keep pre-prepared obituaries of people of note because it takes a while to write these things, and you kind of want to get them up pretty soon. And then they will just update them and airbrush them a little. And what's been said is that this obituary was based on a stock obituary that was written by someone who has since passed, and therefore perhaps it's not fair to give this person's name. Of course, the fact that Colleen McCulloch has passed, and it seems certainly fair to insult her and denigrate her career as one of Australia's best-selling authors, it seems okay by the Australian.
Am I wrong in saying, did it continue on talking about how she still had many suitors or
many
lovers?
Yeah, exactly.
Yep, yep. So in spite of her disabilities facially
And the fact that she was fat.
And her obesity,
she still managed to get many suitors, which is something there was a quote from her to that effect, that she's not interested in hasn't ever been interested in makeup and fashion and what have you, and yet she hasn't.
Is that what the dead writer was riffing on? The dead obituary writer, not Colleen McCulloch. Isn't that the point, that they were riffing on her words?
Yeah, and I did see someone say a comment to that effect on Twitter that, she talked about her appearance and weight, so it's fair that the obituary does. Two things I'd have to say to that. First of all, sure, if you want to mention it somewhere down the back, fine, but as your opening paragraph?
McCulloch was well aware of being obese and didn't seem to have a problem with it, full stop, like that.
But up the back, not your opening paragraph. The first line mentioned she was a best-selling author, and then I think you had to go three pars in before you got any mention of her creative work. But the other thing you have to ask yourself, is why did she mention her weight and appearance in interviews from time to time? Could it be because she was constantly asked about it as a woman?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, but I'm guessing she didn't sit down for an interview about her latest book and go, by the way, just because I'm a large lady doesn't mean I don't get my jollies.
What I don't get is why no one copy edited it.
But it would have been, right? It would have gone through at least two, if not three people. And no one looked at that opening paragraph and went, hang on. I mean, I don't know when that was originally written, but it wouldn't have been good at any time. But the fact that went to print,
And you know what people are saying. They're saying, you're all so sensitive. Colleen would have loved it. Colleen would have laughed. She would have said, yeah, that's right. I was plain of face and fat. She would have loved it. You're so sensitive for police, fill in the gap.
She may have done. I don't think that they are in any position to talk about what Colleen McCulloch may or may have thought any more than we are. But that's not the point.
Unless she actually wrote the obituary.
She did not write her own obituary. Yeah. And the way that the life and the worth of a female author has been framed in her passing is deplorable.
Yeah, okay. No, yeah. I agree. It's not good.
No. So just wanted to have a little rant about that.
I didn't want to rant in particular. I just wanted to bring up an issue that reoccurs every year. In fact, I was going to write a blog post about it and then deleted it on the idea that I've...
Self-censorship.
A bit of that. But mostly I'd just rather my blog be about book reviews and stuff about awards. So if you're not interested, given that if you're not interested in that, you don't have to read my blog ever.
Fair enough.
You know, I don't want people to think there might be something interesting.
Performing a public service.
Yeah, I don't want people to think there might be something potentially interesting in their blog, so they have to keep it in their feed. I want them to know, no, it's just going to be book reviews of books you've probably never read and commentary on awards that you probably don't care about. So you can just dismiss me completely and not have to, you know, I don't have to take a bandwidth.
Very thoughtful of you.
Isn't it? Because there are too many people out there who write interesting things on their blogs.
I will unfollow you right now.
Well, you should. Too many people write interesting things on their blogs and intersperse it with boring stuff, and you just feel compelled to.
Yeah, fair enough.
Anywho, I wanted to discuss self-promotion and promotion in particular during award season.
As is now upon us.
Yes. Not specifically about the Sad Puppies 3 slate that is out and, in fact, has been discussed in an article. Which
I was not aware of.
No, but anyway.
I mean, I was aware of the Sad Puppies thing, but I didn't realise they'd already published their slate.
Yeah, their slate. Well, there are two versions of it. There's apparently a Sad Puppies version and a Rabid Puppies version.
Oh.
Yeah. I don't know why I know this sort of stuff. Anywho, not particularly about that, but more the environment that exists that's facilitated the existence of Sad Puppies, and that is this idea that every year authors feel that they need to promote their works for the possibility of being nominated for 2 awards, but well, partly the Nebulas, because the Nebulas are voted on by other people of CIFWA, mm-hmm. so that, but really the Hugos, that's really what it comes down to.
Mm. And I guess any other juried awards that happen.
Well, it's popular awards. It wouldn't be juried awards.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Let me say that again.
And I don't know what other, well, the World Fantasy has a popular element to it.
The World Fantasy and the Bram Stokers are both partially a popular nomination and voting.
By the way, the Bram Stoker preliminary ballot, disgraceful.
Can we just not?
Didn't even bother talking about it. It was all men, for one, and for two, it's...
Can we just not?
Why?
Because it's just boring. Get back to your original conversation, which was much more interesting.
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe not. So I don't promote this podcast at this time of year because I find it uncomfortable, which I think needs to be teased out. But I wanted to know what your thoughts were.
Yeah, it's interesting. A few years ago, I can't remember whether it was for 1 or 2 years, I did put a thing on my blog. It was around about the time when everyone was talking about doing this and making your work, you know, reminding people of the work you've had. And
just to add in Australia, we've got the DIPMAR, which is also a popular award.
The DIPMARs and various state awards. To be honest, I didn't think very much about it at all. I saw the merit in reminding people of what you'd had out, you know, because if you've read something 10 months ago, you might not necessarily have forgotten it, so to speak, but not realise it was still eligible. But you do. I mean, I forget things all the time. I see things on people's blogs. I read that and I really loved it, but I may not have thought of it if you put me on the spot and asked me to, you know, unless you keep a reading history. So I did it once or twice and then I just stopped. Not for any particular reason, except that I just wasn't comfortable. I guess, as you say, I'm just not comfortable with that kind of self-promotion.
Is that part of our Australian cringe that we discussed last podcast?
It might be. I do not have a problem, you know, saying, "Hey, I've got a book out." I felt less concerned with spruiking for awards, if that's even the right word.
Isn't that what it is, though?
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. So I haven't done it for a while and it didn't bother me that other people did, and it's all well and good. I mean, to be honest, I'm not highly invested in the awards process.
No, but now that we've got this whole Sad Puppies kerfuffle going on, say that people getting all upset about it, I think it needs to be something that has to be discussed about this whole thing.
Well, I have to say, I hadn't noticed the Sad Puppies thing come up this year. I was certainly aware of it last year, but I've got to say, like, people have just started in the last month putting up all of their eligibilities, and for the first time, and I can't even put my finger on what it was, except that maybe it's just a critical mass effect. But for the first time, I actually kind of could feel what people who are opposed to this practice are saying, in that it kind of feels like the, here's my stuff, if you like me, vote for this. Which is not, I've not seen anyone explicitly say that. You know, it's all framed around, here's just my stuff that's eligible and it has to be as a reminder, really, because you can't really start reading all of that stuff in order to vote for it. Certainly not with the Nebulas that are come out very soon. With the Hugos, you could. I guess you could. You can look at if you gathered everyone's eligibility stuff for last year, you could start reading and have a lot written by the time the Hugos are ready to be nominated and voted on. So I'm not saying anyone said it. It was kind of an impression I started to get that it almost didn't matter if you'd read the work or read that particular work, but if you liked that author, here's some stuff that you could vote for them for. And yeah, I can't put my finger on why this year I've had that kind of a feeling. And as I said, no one has actually said it. No one has said, here's my stuff. If you like me, pick something and put it on a ballot.
So the view is that if you don't do it, what happens is that people end up nominating the top of mind writers who have a public face anyway, distinctive from their work.
Which I have a lot of sympathy for that position, and it is a valid argument.
And as a result, and as most top of mind writers are usually white males, what happens is ballots get stacked with white males because they're the one. That's the assumption.
Yep.
So that's the view. There's also a view in there about gatekeeping as gatekeepers as well, and make those authors all keep quiet so that we can control what gets on ballots and what doesn't get on ballots, which I don't really – anyway, but there's an argument like that. So and more so there's an argument about diversity and – which leads into the – connects to the first argument, diversity and promoting, people of colour, et cetera.
Mm.
So my concern though is why do we wait till awards season to promote these – writers who don't know. Well, there's two things. One is, why do we wait?
Mm-hmm.
And two, unless person of color or minority group writer is signal boosted by someone else,
mm-hmm.
they're unlikely to get past their 15 friends on Facebook, assuming that's what they have. Okay, because if they're already popular.
So a lesser known author.
Yeah, so if they're already popular.
So a lesser known author doing their awards promotion, awards eligibility post, isn't going to have any effect anyway, is what you're saying.
Correct.
Because
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, because it's not the fact that necessarily it's a top of mind thing, it's a visibility thing.
And to his credit, John Scalzi opens up a page specifically for this. He says, this is where everyone can put in what they read and liked and either their own work or work of others. Except by about the 400th post, it's just a blur. I mean, who's reading all
and
that?
And that's the problem.
Other than the people who are actually typing in, I wrote this, who's actually actively reading that stuff?
Yeah, and I guess that's entries. The problem with – so, I mean, in Australia we have the DITMAR wiki, which is set up.
Which is great.
Which is great, except that, by the time the whole thing is completed and everyone's put in everything they've written or have read, it's a huge wiki. Like, it's massive.
And that's Australia.
And that's just Australia. So if you're going to set up like a world wiki for Hugo eligibilities, there would just be so much noise, wouldn't there?
Yeah. It is a hard one. I want to say that I'm against the whole thing because ultimately it leads to the sad puppy type conundrum.
So your argument is because a culture of awards eligibility posts has been set up for, possibly purposes of good, it has enabled the opposite effect.
Well, yeah, because if the point was ultimately to promote writers from minority groups, etc., that's been now drowned out over the last 3 weeks.
Was that the ultimate point? Promote writers from minority groups? It wasn't.
It's
promote writers.
It's to justify it. It feels like to me, to justify it, that's the argument that's used.
Mm.
Not by people being disingenuous, I should point out, but just that when some people say, look, I'm doing it because I want to promote my work, but I'm also the sort of person who doesn't get much exposure, okay? So it's not being disingenuous, but if that was – okay, I'm just putting it in that context. If that was the point, it's now being drowned out by all this discussion, not by necessarily the sad puppy people, but the people around sad puppies talking about how it's Hugo's ballot stuffing and it's the worst thing in the world. I mean, to his credit, I love Mike Lyer's File 770 posts on this. They're quite funny because they're so sarcastic, but and it's not just him, but it's more the Twitterverse and my Facebook feed and, oh, dear God, how can we allow these people to – I mean, they have every right to promote, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see a Hugo ballot that's just going to be filled with libertarian and right-wing fiction and it's the end of the world. But we created that world, didn't we? I mean, isn't that the world created?
I mean, you create that world as soon as you have a popular ballot. That's it.
I wonder, though, when you look at what the Sad Puppy conveners say about why they do what they do, it comes down to that they feel that the Tor.coms and SIFWAs of this world have the voice and have pushed their agenda. Now it's time for them to push theirs. And a lot of that pushing of agenda seems to be around awards eligibility mm-hmm. posts and that sort of self-promotion.
Because awards are they're a visible nexus of the whole year and the whole publishing industry. They're a place where everything is shown in one spot.
Mm.
You don't have to go around like, here's your shortlist. Here's all the stories we as a community or an industry think are worth your while, which is why they're of importance or seen to be of importance and influence. Now, if you have a popular ballot, anyone can vote on it.
See, what you said to me in the car, again, because we do talk into the car about the podcast, it's a mistake, we shouldn't do it, but we do, is that, you know, you put a lot of credibility in the posts of independent third parties, like you said, Jonathan Mackelmon, I'm thinking Abigail Nussbaum and mm-hmm. others.
Yeah.
But then the argument is, oh, yeah, but they're essentially just gatekeepers as well, because they're not going to read Larry Correa's latest Monster Hunter Nation novel or John C. Wright's latest book. They're only going to read the stuff that politically is in their,
of course,
is in their bailiwick, and therefore,
well, that's, but that is what we all do. We all read the stuff that we think is worthwhile for various reasons, and we recommend that. But you know, the Sad Puppies have a valid point. They are just doing what everyone's doing. I mean, their politics are different. Their what they value in a book is different. Does that mean they don't get a vote?
No, and they've always had a vote.
Yeah.
They've always had a vote, but now they've banded together.
Well, that's no real difference.
Well, I suppose what I'm asking is, are we going to get to a point 3-5 years down the track? Because Our Puppies isn't going to stop, especially if they get nominees on the Hugo ballot this year and even potentially winners. Are we going to get a point where we get these two central left-wing, right-wing tranches of ballots put up by people?
Well, maybe.
Is this what we want?
It's a popular ballot. That's how they work.
So really the problem's with the Hugos, and we just should get rid of the Hugos and just have everything.
I didn't say
yeah,
that.
Basically that's what you are saying.
No, I'm just – this is how it works. And, you know, an award like the Hugos or to, you know, the Nebulas or to a lesser extent the Stokers, the World Fantasies, Ditmars, any of these awards which draw on a popular ballot will have all of these issues. Their ballots are formed – by a diverse group of people who may or may not have read more than one book that year that they liked, which is fine. They're not put together from a basis of authority, and that's their whole point. Their whole point is that as an awards, we're not going to be gatekeepers. We're not going to pretend that we've read everything and know everything and have picked the best stuff.
Yep.
That's the strength that they're going with. But that does mean that everyone gets to input into the ballot.
I agree, but I just think it's sad that we've got to a point where we have to essentially choose a side. That's just what it feels like.
Do you have to choose a side or do you have to choose a book?
Well, no, no, that's the point. It was just choose whatever you like,
yeah.
Vote for it. Now it feels like you've got to choose a side.
Well,
whether that's not necessarily putting up a ballot but attacking the other guy's suggestions because they're just terrible people or whatever.
Well, look, I think it's
I know it's the internet age and that's sort of where we're at. Politics is in everything we do. I mean, shit, there's politics in this podcast.
And
I don't want to be in the same room as you, but I am. You know,
to a certain extent, to quote Tyler Durden, let the chips fall where they may. This is what it is. I will point out that there was much, much angsting and wringing your hands over the fact that Robert Jordan's series got put onto the Hugo ballot last year.
Well, I agree. I think that was stupid too.
And everyone was saying it's unfair. They're just going to be infiltrated by Robert Jordan fans who will just buy a supporting membership to vote and it doesn't reflect the community and blah, blah, blah.
And yet it didn't win.
And yeah, well, it didn't win. And why didn't it reflect the community? I mean, how insular do we want our community to be? You can love Robert Jordan, but you also have to read this.
It's not that. I think it was more that how can you compare apples with oranges when you're comparing a corpus of, you know, 1.5 million words versus a novel.
Sure. I mean, that was
my problem.
But there was a lot of people running around going, oh, these grimy little Robert Jordan fans who'll take over our awards.
Oh, okay.
If you've bought a membership and you've voted for a book you really like, it's as much your award as anyone else. And that goes for the Sad Puppy people. Now, I think where I would want to draw a line is if the Sad puppy people or anyone. And as I said, it's kind of a impression I was getting earlier this year, who are just drawing up a ballot and say, vote for this, regardless of whether you've read it, regardless of whether you like it, just to make a political point.
Yep.
I think that approach undermines an award. I don't care what you vote for, as long as you've read it and you liked it and you think it should get an award.
It would be fascinating.
And if your politics are different to mine, that's fine.
It would be fascinating to know how many people who do get a supporting membership so they can vote the sad puppies in, and any other eligible person, how many of the books are they actually read?
And that's not something that can ever be captured or policed.
Yeah.
And this is the thing. Popular award. You take the weaknesses and disadvantages of that award with its strengths and advantages.
See, you know, I'm thinking there's less and less strengths. I'm thinking it is now just becoming weakness and disadvantages, these sorts of awards. But anyway, the Hugos aren't going
People
anywhere.
Cannot be trusted to vote for awards.
No, they can't.
You're a gatekeeper.
Correct. I probably am standing like one, yeah.
But no, I do take your point. But yeah, as I said, the only thing I would object to would be the notion that on either side, you know, if a whole bunch of people got together and voted for anti-sad puppy things that they thought would have the best chance of getting on a ballot and winning without necessarily reading them and or liking them and or thinking they were worthy of an award, that would be just as bad. I'm not saying the sad puppy people are doing that. They've probably read and loved the things they're voting for and they're really upset they're not getting on ballots.
I think it was more that – not that their voice wasn't heard because they can get a supporting membership and vote.
Yeah.
It's that they just didn't think that they had a part to play. They feel disenfranchised, that the left had taken over SF and their one vote wasn't going to do the job, so why bother? Now, it wasn't until Sad Puppies came along and said, hey, we can all get together and make a point, that they said, oh, okay, we do have a voice. But individually, they didn't feel that they could do much because they perceived that the left had taken over.
But it's interesting, though, because
I think is bullshit. I'm sorry, I just want to put politics on out here. I think it's bullshit because I don't think the left had taken over anything. I think people were just voting.
And I think also the problem is that no, I agree with you. I don't think there's a leftist conspiracy to stack the Hugo ballot. I think it reflects a shift in culture and a shift in how we perceive the genre and what we expect from the genre. But the implication of what you just said, that people didn't feel they could make any effect unless they all got together and decided on what to vote for, that feels to me like stacking a ballot. Because that doesn't feel like people voting for the stuff they like. That feels like an orchestrated, rather cynical attempt to go, well, let's all just vote for this one thing, regardless of whether or not we've read it and liked it, because it will get on the ballot.
And look, there'll be a mixture of that.
And that's, as I said, I think that type of thing undermines the awards. But you can't police it. You can't police it. You can't prevent it. You can't make everyone sit an exam about the book they're voting for to make sure they've read it. It's a popular award. It is what it is.
I'm going to segue here.
You're going to segue.
Yes. Talking about a book that should be on many ballots is The Bitterwood Bible by Angela Slater.
Slater.
I always say Slater.
I know. Everyone does.
There's someone at work who has a similar surname and really not relevant. Slater. How does she know it's Slater, by the way?
Her grandmother told her.
Is that a for real story?
That is a for real story. I got that from Angela's mouth.
Wow. So do you
her
think
grandmother
she
said, we are Slaters.
At what point in her childhood, like when she was five and once said Slater and her grandmother took her by the ear?
I didn't ask her by the ear and said,
it's Slater.
I did not ask her in detail.
Well, I want the full story. All right.
Well, maybe Angela can write to us and tell us the full story.
But anyway, look, the point I was trying to make was that this is a book that should appear on many juried ballots and it's already on the Locus reading list.
Yep, that just came out last week.
The recommended reading list.
The recommended reading list.
And so it should be. And it should, I hope, to see it on the World Fantasy ballot too. And, of course, Australia Aurealis. And really, again, preempting, sorry.
All the awards.
I haven't even spoken about the book yet. So, The Bitterwood Bible. Now, you chose it.
I did.
You had not read it, but you had read Sourdough, hadn't you?
I had not read it. I'd read Sourdough, and I've long been a fan of Angela's work.
And I've long been a friend of Angela, but really only read, I think, one short story. So not much of a friend creatively.
Not much of a friend.
But now I've read a full book by her. I think I may have lied to her and told her I've read something by her, but that would have been a lie.
Angela, he's lying. He's lying.
But now I can say I have genuinely read something by her.
She'll curse you now. She can do that.
Okay. Sourdough, bitterwood.
So so the Bitterwood Bible and other recountings. Ian hasn't gotten the physical book. He read it on as an e-book.
Yep.
And he's just seen the physical book this morning, and you're quite blown away.
Well, I know Tartarus Press do gorgeous things. This is gorgeous.
It is a gorgeous, gorgeous book. And can I just put it out there? I know it's probably practically impossible, but books with ribbons in them should be more of a thing. I loved my little bookmark ribbon. I miss books with ribbons in them. Anyway.
It's funny because every e-book program you have has a ribbon.
Has a ribbon as a little thing that
and
you tick.
And your books themselves don't have ribbons. Yeah.
Anyway, Tartarus Press does beautiful books with ribbons in them. It's wonderful. So it is a physically gorgeous book, and I even though it's a podcast and no one can see it, I will spend 30 seconds just saying how beautiful it is. The stock is nice and thick and creamy.
That cover, when you take the front off.
Yeah, the embossing on the cover.
That is just gorgeous.
It's just the most beautiful. It and Sourdough, two absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous physical books.
And to their credit, Tartarus is starting to really make it in terms of awards and those sorts of things. Because it was Rupetta a Tartarus book?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, so that won the Tiptree.
Yep.
And they've got a nominee on the new inaugural James Herbert Award.
Okay.
So, which is, I think, the Loney, I think it's called, the Loney, not the Lonely, it's the L-O-N-E-Y. It's Lonely by Andrew Michael Hurley. So they're making ground here.
They make beautiful books inside and out.
But they're smart. They offer an e-book.
And also paperback editions, which are priced significantly lower than their hardcovers, which are not cheap, I will have to say. They are worth the money, I think, because they are gorgeous books. And if you are a collector of physical books as artifacts, they are beautiful, but they're not cheap. But a lot of the books have a paperback version and, as you say, ebooks as well. So yes, you can read the stuff without having to mortgage your house.
And to be fair, the ebook versions are really cheap.
Yeah, they are. Anyway, so the Bitterwood Bible is...
And other recountings.
And other recountings. Is a follow-up book to Sourdough and Other Stories, but it is set in a time previous to Sourdough. So it's
Will I have missed bits?
No.
Because
no.
I didn't feel like I had. I didn't feel like I needed to read Sourdough.
Well, you won't miss it because it's a prequel.
No, but I was thinking...
In a sense.
Is there like foreshadowing and stuff that leads into Sourdough
that
I wouldn't have picked up on?
Look, it's really interesting, and I'll apologise in advance, listeners, because I read Sourdough, when it first came out, so several years ago. Having read Bitterwood, I turned around and reread Sourdough straight away. So, and I was thinking on my way here, they're bleeding into each other. So, I might have a slight trouble differentiating what story went
where. So, for example,
where.
The Coffin Maker's Daughter, who's quite a powerful character.
Hepzibah Ballantyne.
Yeah, see, the name's, I'm sorry.
Gorgeous name.
Yeah, it is a gorgeous name. But does she or her lineage appear in Sourdough?
Okay, well, she's neat, actually. So
this is why I do this podcast, so you can tell me
I'll
this stuff.
I'll give you a very rough background.
Okay,
Sourdough and Other Stories formed the basis for Angela Slater's PhD thesis. And so that was the central core creative work of her PhD. And she wrote the exegesis around the idea of a mosaic novel functioning as a type of involuntary memory, so that as you're reading the stories and little references to others pop up, they will recall a memory, which is an involuntary memory, as though when you're living your life and some little things happen and you get this flash of a memory that you hadn't have thought of, you hadn't smelt that thing or seen that picture or someone mentioning a word, right? These little – so she wrote
– That's really interesting. Okay.
And she wrote around that. And Sourdough has intersecting characters, two or three stories that as with Bitterwood, very explicitly follow each other, but a lot of stories that didn't interconnect explicitly but may have had a reference here or there, which would act as a spark to memory, I suppose. What was really interesting, having read Bitterwood, and I don't think Bitterwood is doing that because I think the stories are much more connected. It's much more of a tapestry of a book that
Bitterwood more than
Bitterwood.
Sourdough.
Yes.
Sourdough, yep.
So I don't think any of or most of the references they're not little sparks of memory. They are very explicit.
No, in fact, once you get halfway through, it feels like this is the threads are being picked up.
So you're very actively being asked to
remember what you read.
To remember what you're reading, to actively remember it, as opposed to just involuntary little, oh, that reminds me sort of thing. But what was really interesting, like having read Bitterwood, and yeah, I love Bitterwood. I liked Sourdough a lot. I just fucking loved Bitterwood.
Tartarus, that is a good blurb for the novel. I like Sourdough, but I just
a lot. I like Sourdough a lot.
I like Sourdough a lot. But I just fucking loved Bitterwood.
Yeah. Let's keep going. So I went back and read Sourdough, and there's I think it might be the final story, or it's one of the very last stories in Sourdough. And there's a character there who's just walking through a graveyard, and one of the names on the tombstones is Hephzibah Ballantyne. And that's it. That's the only time Hepzibah's in Sourdough. But for me, like reading that in that story, it worked as that involuntary memory thing from this other book, because I wasn't reading Sourdough with a view to trying to actively remember Bitterwood, so to speak. And just having that thing just as a name on a tombstone in a graveyard
and,
in another
and the
story.
Irony of being a coffin maker that the
and then so and this is I think what Angela's done in writing Bitterwood is to go back and tease out a lot of the backstory of some of the characters and some of the stories in Sourdough, but also just to create new other stories still set in the same world and intertwining with those backstories, but not necessarily it's not a like a complete mapping onto Sourdough. It's all the same world. These stories have been set in a previous time, you know, a generation or two in some cases, and they're illuminating more of the world.
Okay, so it's not like that Sourdough is the kids of the people in this
Some of
book.
Them are, yeah.
Okay.
Some of them are, but not all of them. And there are stories in Sourdough that I mean, I'd have to do an ultra-close reading, but they do seem to stand alone and maybe not referenced at all in Bitterwood.
Now, we're talking about a secondary world. We're not talking about actual Earth.
It's a secondary world. It's sort of like a continental European kind of a world.
Yeah. It did sometimes just feel like Europe with the name Europe shaved off.
Yeah, well, it can be that. Because it's not a world that, apart from the fact that
a bit of Russia thrown in.
Apart from the fact that there's magic and fairies and selkies, it's not like the world itself
and grimoires.
Well, magic, right?
Yeah.
The world itself is very much our world, so people don't go. So there's not like strange things happening all the time,
or even strange terminology. So horses are horses.
A horse is a horse.
A badger is a badger.
You know, everything works the way it does in our world, except it takes a lot of the folk tale and mythology and fairy tales of our world, and not necessarily brings their narratives in here, but uses their mechanics and their magic. So there is magic. There are people who can do spells, and the spells work. The Earl King is in this book, as he is in Sourdough. So it's this amalgam of a mimetic novel in terms of it's the physical structure of the world and how the mechanics of that world works. And over the top of that is the stuff that we know about. We know about this type of magic. It all feels very familiar.
Well, there's vampires as well.
There are vampires, yeah. But it's all very familiar. Nothing feels out of joint.
By the way, that vampire story,
it's one of my favourites.
There can't possibly be a refreshing take on vampires, but she does that.
Yeah, I like the vampire story, the night stare.
Anyway, keep going.
It's a really good one.
Well, it's just because, you know, it's these families who want to be chosen so their daughters can go up to this castle and be with the masters. You know, they're all vying. And this one daughter who essentially sabotages the competition so she can be chosen because she wants to know what happened to
her sisters.
Was a sister? I think it was two. Wasn't it two sisters? Well, anyway, it doesn't matter. Sisters, and to find out really what the horror is, and then it's just the brilliance of it from that point on. And and then that recurring character who comes in, who pops up throughout quite a few of the stories.
And it's
sort of villain of
Ricky
the
character.
Yeah, the villain of the.
The man. Yes.
Yes.
The arch kind of priest mage guy who rides through most of the
book. Is looking for a full copy of the Bitterwood Bible.
Yeah.
Yeah. which, again, just beautiful. Just not only is it feeding on the stories before and then the ones after, but it's a great vampire story.
Yeah, it is. And
it uses all the vampire tropes with masters and, you know, master of the, you know, and all the stuff down in the basement.
But it's interesting because it's playing with the idea of, you know, these, for all intents and purposes, immortal creatures, but they're so wedded to actually to stasis.
Yes.
And, you know, so the woman wants children and she's only interested in them when they're passive little children. She's not interested in the children changing and growing.
Yeah.
So you have these creatures who would span centuries.
Oh, yes. But and the jealousy she feels when she starts to get along with the husband.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're making things recall in my head.
so yeah, it's a world that feels quite familiar in that we know how this world works because it's almost our world. And even the magic side of stuff, Angela doesn't have to spend a whole lot of time or very much time at all in explaining how any of her magic works because it's a very familiar magic to us. We know this type of magic from fairy tales and folklore. We know this. So it's quite intuitive when any of this stuff happens, we accept it because it is familiar. That's not to say that it's, you know, it's old hat or it's
But that's the cliched. Point. It's familiar without being cliched or predictable or even traditional.
Because
it feels traditional but also quite radical in its approach.
Because I don't think the focus of the book is not the world and the magic and how that works. The focus of the book is the human relationships and the intergenerational narratives.
Mothers,
that run
daughters,
through the
grandmothers.
Book.
That...
And, I mean, the story, the St. Dinford's School for Poison Girls, which is another one of my favourites.
You remember that title without looking at anything. I just want to sell it because people won't know. You just plucked that literally.
No, but St. Dinford's School for Poison Girls, this is a school where young girls go, it's like a finishing school. So young girls go there and they learn how to eat properly and talk properly and wear their hair right and be good little ladies and good wives so they can then kill their husbands or sometimes their sons. But it's all done.
As part of a revenge.
It's all done as a part of an often intergenerational, sometimes centuries old feud between families. So...
And all these girls know that they will die as well because they will kill and then, of course...
They will be killed.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is what Bitterwood does. It's looking at these grand narratives that do span generations.
And that story is also a spy story.
Yes, it is. Yes, because the lead character...
has been planted in there to find the book.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's... So it's even got espionage. Even espionage is in this.
And pirates.
And pirates. Oh, yes, there's pirates.
The pirate story is beautiful. It's really. It doesn't seem to link in with the other. Like, it seems to stand almost apart from the others. It's in the same world.
No, because doesn't it have. No, it does link in because it's got the woman that she finds in the cabin at the end who's essentially become this sort of Lovecraftian tentacle thing. And that woman is the husband of the one that was cursed in a previous story.
That woman is the husband.
The wife.
That woman is the wife. Oh, yes, you're right.
You're making me remember, and I always ramble when I remember.
Yes, the story about the voiceless, the woman whose tongue is cut out.
Well, that's right. And
right.
There's the curse. I think it's a curse. And she becomes, and that wife, innocent really, it's not her fault that this guy fell in love with her, becomes basically a Lovecraftian disgusting octopus menace tentacle
thing.
That's
right, yes.
So it is very much connected.
Yes, yes.
But also probably one of the best pirate stories I've read in a long time.
It's a really good pirate
because
story.
Because it's got that, you know, you've got the nameless horror or the horror of the sea, you know, that sort of squid-like Leviathan type thing, and yet it actually happens to be just this poor woman who's been cursed and has a tragic story to tell, even though she's essentially killed everyone. And it's... And I think the pirate character appears again as well, the pirate captain.
I don't think she appears later.
Maybe she doesn't.
I think she does, but I could be wrong. I would have to read.
Can you please do a closer reading of this book, person? Because you obviously remember none of it, including the titles.
So terrible. that is what this book does so well. It entwines all of these stories. The first story, which is about the coffin maker's daughter, her story goes over the whole book and she's in the last story. like her, what happens to her, which I'm not going to give away because I don't. We don't need to give a lot of spoilers here, which is a good thing.
Yeah, we can talk generally because it's just short stories.
And you've got a story where you have the girl who is transcribing the Bitterwood Bible.
Can I just say, please, that Can I please say she turns into a badger?
She turns into a badger because she falls in love
with a badger.
With a badger who has been accidentally magically turned into a man by her.
I don't read many stories where people – I mean, there are plenty of stories where they turn into a werewolf or some other. But badgers, that's pretty new to me.
But it's quite an unexpected ending. Like the
Which
ending
I'll probably
you'd,
just spoil.
You'd, well, the ending you'd expect is that she would find a way to turn her badger back into the man.
Yeah, but
– but instead she turns into the badger.
And that constantly gets
and
referred
to. And she dies
to.
As the badger. We'll find out later when the – because she takes the book and takes it with her.
As a badger.
As a badger. And we find out later someone has found this book inexplicably. They don't know why. They found it in a badger's den amid these two little skeletons of two badgers. And of course,
but
you know
you go,
what's
did, but
happened.
But didn't you go, oh.
I know, and oh.
The poor lovelorn badgers.
You know, badgers don't live as long as humans, so.
Yeah, but they did badger sex and love. And
why? Oh, they just had little badger lives.
Yeah. Did they have badger kids, you think?
I don't know. Well, there might be a third volume.
The third volume. The Badger Kids.
The Badger Kids.
And other stories that Ian might want written by Angela in the future.
That's a very long subtitle.
Yeah, Tartarus will sort it out. Yeah. Anyway.
That's like all these things link back, and the beauty of writing a collection of stories like this is you don't have to explain any of them in any one story. You know, like you have this that story on its own. Oh, I found this book in a badger den. If you were just reading that on its own, it'd be like, wait a minute.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a bit convenient, but because we've already seen the story of the badgers and how that book got there, it's this wonderful added texture. And so Slater doesn't have to do that with every story.
So here's my metafictional question then. Not metafictional, but meta something. Okay. Much like the Ali Smith, which we're going to talk about, could this be in a best novel category? Because the Ali Smith is also not a traditional novel. Isn't this doing everything a novel does?
I don't know. It's a difficult question. I mean, where you draw the line between a novel and a short story collection and where what is termed a mosaic novel actually falls.
But that term mosaic novel's always bugged me.
Yeah, I don't know. I look at this as a short story collection where the short stories do speak to each other. I'm not sure that it's a novel. I don't think there is – when I think about, you know, kind of the definition of what we talk about when we talk about novels is you're really looking for this – rather strong narrative that runs through the whole book.
Don't you have that here? You've got a villain who runs through most of the stories. Yes, you've got different characters.
Well, this is like a history, though.
But you've got the MacGuffin even that runs.
But this is like a history.
Yeah, but I've read novels that are also put together as histories, but they're not. Yeah. They're just not done as distinct short stories.
Yeah. I don't know. It's as I said, it's interesting. I think it's a definition.
The Alan Moore book, that was it Angela who recommended it?
Yes.
Now, that was class.
I was going to bring up the Alan Moore
Voices
book.
Of Fire, whatever it's called. That was classed as a novel.
Yeah. And again, that was a history being told of the place through different time periods and characters.
And if it ever comes out, Jerusalem, his next one does exactly, it's about 20,000 pages long. But if it ever, that's
don't
assuming it ever sees
recommend
a lot of
that.
No, that. I'm not going to recommend it. But that also has been classed as a novel by him. Now, this book is far more coherent in it. Well, not coherent. Yes,
it is more coherent.
from a novel perspective than Voices of Fire or whatever it was called. So I get confused by this.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I don't know. As I said, I don't know where you set the demarcations for what is a novel and what is – short stories
well,
that refer to each other.
You said a critical thing about the Badger story, which I'm just going to call now the Badger story, that there's the ending could be deemed convenient if you didn't have the stuff before.
Well, not the ending of the Badger story. Like the Badger story sits on its own, but when the finding of the Bitterwood Bible is referenced back to the Badger story.
Okay, well, let's go to that story. Sorry, I apologize.
But,
let's go to that story.
Yeah.
Could you, because you're sort of then half arguing that you couldn't take that story out and put it in a year's best collection or a.
Well, no, you could. If you weren't writing it to fit into Bitterwood, there was no reason for that book to be in a badger's den. Other than that, we knew that that's where the book was last found, or last been. So, like in that story where that reference is made, there's no need for it to be in a badger's den. Angela hasn't written a story to justify why this book was in a badger's den. She's referenced
okay.
a previous story. This book could have been found in any odd place.
Okay.
So it's not so much that the stories necessarily are required to support each other in a narrative sense. It's just that they do entwine and link together with each other and sort of have tendrils reaching out and going back to each other, which makes it a really wonderful way to read a short story collection because it does feel more cohesive. Whether it's a novel, I don't know. I don't know if it was a novel that I'd particularly like it, if you know what I mean. I like
well, if it had novel on the front, the exact same content, but it had the word a novel.
No, I mean like if you like your overarching story that yeah. you're saying, well, there's the villain who's being pursued, and I don't know that would make such an interesting novel if that was the focal narrative.
Okay. Oh,
of
I see
the
what
book.
You're saying. Okay, yeah, okay, understood.
But because it's just this undercurrent,
okay, I got you. Yep.
Then the book as a collection of you know a meshed and interlinked short stories works beautifully, and that's what it gets to do. It gets to bring out all the lives of these different people. And bring them into focus for a bit to look at their story, but also to acknowledge how their story goes back into the past and into the future to affect, you know, other generations and other stories. So it's this wonderful linkage of narrative.
It's it builds to a crescendo. It does all fantastic. I just want to focus as well on the writing, which I know you would think is beautiful, lush and...
Very elegant writing.
And very elegant. But also that it has a literary quality. I know.
We're not going to have that debate again.
No, we're not. I'm not going to have that debate. However, what I will say is that – well, no, what I do want to say is that there's a tragedy behind this a bit that we have some amazing genre writers and Angela is most definitely one of them. And this book just – if it's a capstone on that, not on her career but just on the fact that she is – peerless her writing
in this book is so powerful, and having, as I said, just read Sourdough back to back of it, it's more precise, more focused than the writing. There was nothing wrong with the writing in Sourdough. It's a beautifully written book, but the writing in Bitterwood is just got much more strength to it, and the writing feels a lot more confident in its voice. So, and Angela's able to mediate between different voices and different the need for occasionally for a different style. So there's some stories who are in the first person, but even in the stories which are all in the third person, there are very subtle shifts in language use and vocabulary, so that the book doesn't feel like it is all written in the one voice. And she's not showy about that. I think it's a very – it's an author who's very –
it's a bit restrained.
It is. It's an author who's very confident about letting the stories speak in the way that they need to, and not needing to be really showy with the style or the language or the vocab that's used. They're very much suited to the stories that they're telling and the characters who are either speaking or being spoken about.
I think, I don't know how to phrase this without sounding like a complete fuckwit. But to me, it always upsets me that there isn't thousands of copies of this book out. That thousands and thousands of
You know what upset me? It's funny because, as you know, after reading a book, I go on the interwebs and I look up reviews and stuff like. I couldn't find any mainstream reviews for this outside of one in the Australian newspaper.
What about genre reviews?
Because
that's
not major ones. Like there's a handful on people's blogs and things like that. Yep. Alex from Galactic Suburbia did a very nice review. There's one on 13 O'Clock, which is an Australian horror and dark fantasy blog. But in terms of Tor, Strange Horizons, it did get a 1-star review in Publishers Weekly, which is excellent. But that's focused towards
the trade,
the industry, yep, rather than the public. So yeah, that made me really sad.
Well, that's the thing. What do we have to do? I mean, talk about, you know, we just spent half an hour talking about promoting, you know, writers. This is what's being missed out.
Well, we're doing this.
Yeah, but I just don't feel like it's enough.
It's never enough, Ian. It's never enough.
That is actually quite sad. Mm. And I don't know if it's because I know it's part published by Tartarus. Tartarus are not like
part of it Australia. Is that it's a small press.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah, but okay. That I accept. And the books aren't expensive though. If you buy the ebook, it's not like. And they would, and I'm certain Tartarus send out review copies, and they're getting to jurors because they're getting on award ballots. So, you know, it's not just this one. I mean, Nikki Selway's book, Repetta, which wasn't my favourite book of last year, but I think it's a very solid book, won the Tiptree.
Yeah.
But, you know, it didn't get much exposure beyond that. And is it an Australian thing? Because they're both Australian writers.
But this is a UK press.
I know, so that's what I don't get. I think it's sad. Not sad in a I'm going to go off and cry away, but sad in that I want Angela to go from strength to strength, because this is just a remarkable piece of writing.
It really is. It really is. And I think you should read Sourdough. I think you'd really like it.
When I'm done my 5 years of reading award-nominated novels and I've felt that I've done that, I will probably go back. I will, because I'm going to not do that forever.
Not do that forever.
Why?
It would kill you.
Yes. Yes, it will, actually. So, look, you know what we haven't mentioned?
What?
The illustrations.
Oh, yes. The
which book, are in the Kindle version.
Yeah, so Kathleen Jennings has actually, gosh, there must be a couple hundred little.
There's not that many.
They're all the way through. I mean, I'm talking about like the little ones.
Yeah, I know
what
you're talking about.
On the pages and things.
Well, let's do a count. No, we're not going to do a count.
We're not going to do a count. But there are many, 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 many beautiful little ink and wash illustrations by Kathleen
Jennings.
They are just
gorgeous. But they're gorgeous and they complement it and they just do exactly what's required.
It did remind me of reading books when I was, you know, much, much younger, and they would have little illustrations.
You know what was missing? The little thing at the bottom saying, you know, a little quote from the actual, you know, the Roald Dahls and that would have a little excerpt at the bottom of the illustration.
Oh, yeah. Like a subtitle.
Yeah, yeah. So fix that up, Tartarus. Each of those illustrations should have some little.
They didn't need it. So actually talking about linkages back in the book, I will mention that one of the things in Sourdough is that the Bitterwood Bible is mentioned. The author is mentioned as, which it is in the beginning of Bitterwood as well, as Mercianus.
There's a reason I'm not saying any of the names, because I know I'll stuff it up. So I'm letting you do it.
And it's mentioned in Sourdough. And then, of course, in the Bitterwood Bible, which this book is central to as a motif, we get to find out the author's not actually the guy who was thought to be the girl who'd brought the book half completed, or not even half completed, but just filled in with a few spells to the Citadel, and she's the one who ended up writing the book. So it's a nice little twist on what you think you know in Sourdough actually gets sometimes undermined.
See, I did miss out on stuff then.
But it's
well, no, I did. It's you're saying, it's not that important. Well, it is, because it just gives you a level, a layer that I didn't get.
Because in Sourdough, the Bitterwood Bible is this throwaway reference.
No, I know, but I miss. Okay.
So, there are linkage. Like, it is a prequel. So, yes, you do get characters in Sourdough who are descendants of and so on. I actually don't think it matters which order you read them in. It matters, obviously. I don't think one experience is better than the other. I think it would change your experience to have read one before the other, but I don't think it actually matters whether you could read Bitterwood first and then Sourdough, and I think you would get as much enjoyment out of picking up where characters come from and what happens.
That is a perfect segue into our next novel.
I thought you'd like that.
That is brilliant. Did you do that on purpose?
I didn't actually until I was halfway speaking.
You thought, wow, Ali Smith.
And now you've spoiled my segue.
No, we should finish off by saying, yes, loved it.
Highly, highly recommended. I did get an email from someone actually thanking us for recommending this book because they hadn't come across Angela Slater's work before. And even though they said they often didn't agree with us.
Really? People don't agree with us on the podcast?
Well, they're not. Well, they didn't often don't.
Who is this person?
Necessarily like the book that we recommend. They loved Bitterwood.
Wait a second.
Loved it.
Okay, well, yes, and you will all love it. So, all of you. Every one of you who read it. And do that now. I mean, as I said, the ebook is only about £5.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and also, websites out there, please review it.
Yes. I'd love to see some more reviews of
it. Tell Noel Harrison to tell Strange Horizon review edits. Well, we're doing it now on the podcast, aren't we?
You're an idiot.
Okay. Ali Smith, How to Be Both. I recommended this.
You did. I'm very glad you did. I hadn't read any of Ali Smith's work before.
And that segues also because we were talking about awards. This thing's won about 4,000 of them. No, it hasn't.
It's been nominated for a lot.
No, no, it won. It's won. It won the Goldsmith Prize.
I know, but it's been nominated for a lot more than it's won.
It got shortlisted for the Booker.
Yep.
It won the Goldsmith, so it won 10,000 quid, because that's the price of the Goldsmith. It won the Costa Award, which used to be called the White Bread, or Wheat Bread, I don't know.
I think the Wheat Bread.
Is it Wheat Bread? Well, there's no E in
it's Wheat Bread.
It's Wheat Bread. Is that also a brand, or was that actually the...
As opposed to the White Bread Award, which is just for the really boring books that make you constipated.
Every award now is a brand, so Costa is actually coffee.
Yeah, I know, I know.
Man Booker is not a brand.
Well, the Orange was a brand.
Yeah, so is Bailey's.
That's what I mean. Where are they getting the money from? They're not getting the money from governments. Governments don't support the arts anymore.
God, you're so provocative.
Well, that's just a statement of fact.
Yes, and provocative. So this, and it's won something. It's been nominated. It's won awards. It's I think one of the best books, easily one of the best books of 2014. And it's also a fully fledged genre novel. I know, I had to just throw that in there, because who gives a shit, even if that was the case. It's really irrelevant. No, it is. I have been thinking about this, because I made a point somewhere on my blog about how it would be a disgrace if this didn't fall on the World Fantasy Award or something.
It's not going to.
No, of course it's not.
And it shouldn't. I didn't think it is actually a fantasy book.
Of course it's not a fantasy book. And, I mean, I just finished reading A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James, which has a ghost in it. Not an actual ghost, but it's clearly, it's about Jamaica. It's clearly not a genre novel in any way, shape or form. Okay, it just isn't. And that's the same here. I mean, yes, we have a ghost as well.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Well, we have the fractured thoughts of an entity that's claiming to be a 15th century
maybe
artist. I think I'm right in saying 15th century. Anyway, a long time ago, a fresco painter, Francesco del Cossa. There you go. I'm happy to say that name, Francesco del Cossa. 15th century Italian fresco painter.
You just read that off your iPad.
Oh, I did, because my memory's, pretty poor. Plus I've read about 60 books since that. But it's not a he, it's a she. Ha-ha, fluidity of gender. He's a ghost in the book. So, he's a ghost.
Here's what's interesting. Before we start.
Can I mention that Francesco del Cossa is a ghost in
yes,
the book?
Yes. Okay. A spirit.
A spirit. Thanks. Keep going. Yeah.
You said to me that I had to read, because this book is in two parts, yes, and they're both part one, and one has a little plant with eyes for the leaves in front of it, and one has a little security camera.
Yeah.
And you told me I had to read the part with the security camera
first.
Yes, I did. And
did you follow my orders?
Because you had read the other part first.
Did you follow my orders?
I did.
Yes, okay.
Now, I was going to buy the book on as an ebook, but when I went online, I found a really cheap the hardcover was available really cheaply, so I thought, oh, well, I'll just read that because I'm starting to get migraines from screens, so I'm going back to paper books.
God, you're old. Anyway, keep going.
I can hurt you.
I know. Do you remember we used to have a pointy stick?
So, I mean, dude, we moved here and I don't have the pointy stick anymore.
I'm going to also say stop saying keep going because it's very patronising.
Anyway,
yes.
So I ordered my lovely hardcover book, and when it came, I found out later doing a bit of reading around it, they were published in just two different versions, like the same cover, same everything, but one had one story.
Yep.
And the book I got had the camera story second.
Yep.
And it sounds ridiculous, but it informed my reading experience because I was reading that second.
It was meant to.
No, oh, no. You mean, fact that I was reading it second.
Because you felt you'd miss stuff out.
Because I was with the physics. See, with you, you had your iPad and you just went, oh, I'll pick one.
Yeah.
And that was a very clear choice that you made.
Yeah.
And even though essentially I made the same choice.
Not really, because I forced
you. But I did, I could have just said, oh, fuck you, Ian. You don't know what you're talking about. This is clearly how my book is meant to be read.
Yeah.
Like if you didn't have an Ian Mond telling you where to start the book and you just bought this book from the bookshop, you would start it with whichever part happened to be printed in your book.
Which actually takes the choice away.
So there is no choice,
yeah,
right? You are directed by the way we normally read a book to start at the beginning.
Yes.
So it was a random thing, which one you got.
Which was Ali Smith's intent.
Yeah, of course. And I think that's really, really good. But it's interesting how if you have an electronic book, you are making a choice. And if you have a printed book, you are essentially...
Yes,
not making
choice. Well, in a sense,
your choice
is
governed by whichever book you pick
up. The electronic book is both is essentially the book twice.
Yes, but you
most people are not going to flick halfway. No. The electronic book that I've got is the book twice, and you're not going to necessarily flick halfway through to the book to. You don't know. Well, actually, there's a forward that tells you.
You said there were two little icons, and you picked which one you were going to start with. True. Yeah. No, whereas in this book, and as I said, because now if I'd gotten the book that happened to have the camera story first, I would have started at the beginning of the book, the physical book, and read the two stories, which is exactly what I did. But because I'm holding this physical book and I'm starting literally halfway through this physical book, in the back of my mind the whole time is this: what's in all those pages I have not read and shouldn't? Maybe I should have read them first. You know, it's like I'm just saying it was an interesting psychological exercise, which. Yes, but so you did take my choice away. You did give me that very interesting reading
experience. I took a choice away from you that you never had in the first place because you would have just started from the start if I'd not said anything.
Yes, but you made me aware there was a choice. So if you just recommended this book and said, I'm recommending this book,
there was a good reason why I did.
I know, because so we would have a different thing, yes. And I agree with you, but what I'm saying is that actually affected my reading experience because I was well aware that there was all this stuff before where I started.
So you understand that the whole point of this book, which this actually doesn't contradict what you're saying.
No, it doesn't.
The whole point of this book, which Smith actually makes clear in the interviews as well, but it's clear from reading
that there is no right
one to start with. Not that. It's the simultaneousness of the experience. Because when you write, you can't write the same thing going on in the same bit, in the same page.
Yes,
you can't do it. So the whole idea is that if you read, like I did, the Francesco's bit first, when you read the bit about George in the museum looking at the painting, you feel that simultaneous reaction because you know that the spirit, air quotes, that I'm doing with my fingers, is there looking over her shoulder and feeling concerned for George.
Yes.
So it gives you that – it's brilliant. It gives you that amazing – it gives you that simultaneous thing, which is a bit like how Bitterwood makes you recall. Mm. This makes you have that simultaneous experience without her having to actually do it in the text.
Yeah. No, I get that. Genius? I get that.
And you would have got that too because you've run the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely. What I find interesting is
except you would have had it earlier because Francesco's already in the museum. George doesn't come to the museum until later. So you would have had that simultaneous experience because when you're reading about Francesco, you know that this person there is George.
He's George.
But he's not mentioned as George. So you've got that.
Yep.
And you know George's backstory that the spirit doesn't know, although it's sort of getting images of.
Yeah.
But yes, anyway.
But no, what I found really interesting. Very excited. What I found really interesting when I went and looked at the reviews, and for this book there are so many. So I didn't look at them all, but all of the all the prominent ones in all of the major publications and that, every single one of them either explicitly said that they'd read the George part first.
Yeah.
That their version of the book had the George part first. Yeah. Or if they didn't explicitly say which part they read first, the reviews still framed this book around George.
Do you know why?
So this is a book about a 16-year-old girl. Yeah.
Do you know why?
And it's also a book about.
Do you know why?
I don't.
Because the Francesco stuff, if you read that first, I read that first, it is not easy to get into. It's
a whole bunch
of fractured sentences. Yeah, yeah. And you think, what the fuck is this?
Just for a couple of pages.
But it's. There actually is mention because I also looked at the reviews of, it might be hard to get into if you read the Francesco. Actually, that was on Goodreads or Amazon. Someone said, read the George section first because the Francesco section is really hard to get into and you won't appreciate it until you've read the George bit anyway.
Seriously, the fractured sentences are like two pages.
I'm just looking
at it. It's two pages and then she's in the museum.
Yeah, but it's difficult. I'm dead set. This is just look it up yourself. And I bet you the reviewers are the same on that.
But without even talking about whether the text is – they're framing the book as a story about George.
Which it's clearly not.
And I found that really fascinating.
It's clearly a story about George and Francesca. It's clearly a story about frescoes. It's clearly
I found it fascinating that I couldn't find a review where someone had said
– it's a palimpsest.
And as I said, I didn't read through the pages.
I said it's a palimpsest in the right context. Just keep going.
Yeah, I didn't read a review – and there's probably one or two out there, but I – they weren't in the first few pages of Google where someone had said, I read the Francesco stuff first.
Yeah.
Like people had either explicitly said they'd read George's story first or, as I said, if they hadn't gone either way, they were framing this book as a book about George. So you're coming into this, like if you've read those reviews, you're already coming to this book about, this is a book about George. And, and there's this other story that interlinks with it. But I found it quite fascinating that the criticism and review around How to Be Both utterly undermines Ali Smith's project, which is kind of sad.
Is that because it's nearly impossible to write about a book that is trying to do something that's nearly impossible, which is provide a simultaneous narrative experience?
No, I think like there were some very good reviews out there which tackled that and talked about that. I think it was probably written that way because it's easier as a contemporary reader to conceptualize a book which is about a 16-year-old.
But this is also about the conventions.
It's being put in the right order for us our expectations.
The conventions of reviewing requires you to give some sort of précis of the book. Yeah. All reviewers do it. Yeah. It's very hard to do that. That's what I'm talking about, the simultaneous narrative experience. You can't say, this is a book about George and Francesco del Cossa. George is this, Francesco.
But why were they all framing it around George? Why wasn't the framing, this is a book about a 15th century fresco painter, and it's also...
George's experience is the most accessible as a story.
Yeah, but it's really undermining the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely,
absolutely undermining the book.
Is that she hasn't picked two contemporary characters. She's gone out of her way to pick an accessible contemporary character. Mm. And a 15th century fresco painter who's not even the sex she's meant to be.
Well, very accessible. It's written in a contemporary.
The Francesco stuff varies. It's not. It's
just
not,
saying.
It's not. What?
Just saying. It's not written in.
What, 15th century lingo?
Or even pretend 15th century lingo.
Yeah, okay, fair point.
Right? I think it's a very, apart from those first couple of pages of fragmented text while Francesco is coming up through the ground and manifesting, it's very accessible. It's extremely accessible.
It depends what your bread and butter is when you read, okay? The Francesco stuff isn't as accessible, simply partly because it's historical fiction, which I know a lot of people like, you know, Wolf Hall as an example. So it's a character whose gender is fluid, which is also, you know, hurts people's heads. The writing is good, but it's not necessarily
story itself is not as easy to get into. Okay, yeah, no, I'd buy that. I think it's much easier to enter the story in George's head than it is in Francesco's.
And also, I mean, obviously, we can relate to George immediately. It takes and Francesco's a spirit that also doesn't help. You know, so you're going, what the fuck's going on? What, they're in a museum? He's in a museum. He, well, first of all, what sex is this character? Second off, it's in a museum, and why? What's it? How's that relevant? And oh, okay, it's sort of she's sort of recalling her part. Anyway,
no. So I mean, I can certainly see why the reviews and criticism are framed around George.
Okay.
But it does undermine
it's a shame.
What Ali Smith is trying to do. So, yeah, anyway, onto the book itself. I really loved this book. I really, really loved it a lot. And I'm going to have to find more of her work, I think.
It's just, it's so smart because you could argue that she's just throwing stuff at the wall there. As I said, there's stuff on gender. There's stuff on art and the appreciation of art. There's stuff on surveillance and
the whole book is about watching and observing.
Yeah, wait a moment. I was about to say that.
Oh, sorry.
That's my point. There's all this other stuff there. Yeah. There's stuff about daughter-mother relationships, grieving, loss, all that's in there. And you think, well, gosh, shit, there's just a million themes. How does it all come together? But it does, because the book is ultimately about, A, that simultaneous experience I mentioned before, but I think she says it well herself, about the fresco, about the idea that history is and it's actually where George observes this, that it's layered upon layer upon layer upon layer, and we can constantly dig and find new things and new stories to tell, and that's what this book does so
brilliantly. And new interpretations of old stories that we didn't realise.
And you're right, and it's all about observation. It's all about being seen and seeing, which is fantastic.
So I read the George part first and you read the Francesco part first. And I was wondering because I loved George. I loved, loved, loved George. I thought she was wonderful.
I actually lost it. I actually started to cry. I think in the cafe at work again, I seem to be there a lot, when she talks to her brother about the loss.
Which part?
She talks to Henry. I think it's her brother.
Yeah, but
this is into the book. The mother's died.
Yeah.
and she's speaking to Henry just about silly stuff, but it's all about the grieving process, and it's just a beautiful little scene.
The bit about where he's saying he misses.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I read that, and I absolutely love George. And when I flipped back to the front of the book and I was starting to read Francesca's part, it was wonderful because George was there almost from the very beginning.
That's right.
You realise very quickly that this boy that Francesco sees and misgenders in the art gallery must be George looking at that painting. And that was wonderful because George was still there in the story.
Yep.
And now I was getting to see George from a – because George's part is written in the third person, but it's very much a direct third person. So it's very much George's perspective and her point of view. So when you switch to Francesco looking at George, because Francesco is linked psychically to George.
Did you feel Francesco in the George story?
I did, and this is what I wanted to ask you because I was wondering if you'd read Francesco first and then the George story, did you have that same thing?
I felt Francesco, yep, absolutely.
Because I think I would have felt absolutely bereft if the front part of the story didn't have George in it.
And
for a while.
I fell in love with Francesca. Mm. And it couldn't help but go to Wikipedia and find out how much of it was. And she's done her research. It's not.
Yeah.
Francesco Del Cossa was a real person. And though the gender thing is not, is I suppose, Ali Smith's invention, the stuff about the fresco that Del Cossa paints, that's all true. I felt Francesco's presence. Even though we don't start in the museum like this does, and in fact, I don't get to the museum until very late, you just – because it's all talk.
Because it begins with that – with George's mother asking her about this artist and the fresco and would you ask for more money?
So the question about would you ask for more money.
That's the opening conversation of the George
And then all this talk about the trip, they're going to take a trip to have a look at it. And that. So, yes, I felt – And then when George gets there, because I know the Francesco bit, I just feel that Francesco's there. And I think there's sort of a half reference to being looked at, although in the end it turns out to be the woman who fell in love with the mother.
Spy or maybe not spy.
Spy, yeah, but who also had a sort of bond with the mother. And that's really who's doing the observing. But still, I did feel Francesco there.
Oh, that's nice. Because I was wondering, thinking about the George part, how strongly that would have come through.
I mean, part of it is because I've read the Francesco bit and there's little hints and foreshadowing. I'm waiting for those bits to happen in a sense. Even though it's not clear in the Francesco story what those, because as you said, they're psychically linked, what those things are. We just know stuff about something that happens in a house and someone leaves and there's reference to the painting that's on the front cover, which I think is an interesting.
The photograph.
The photograph, on which I love.
Yeah, I love that is on the cover, that photo is, as described in George's part in quite detail, that's there on the cover.
Yeah, it's just.
And the fresco that. Is also described is like a bit of that fresco. In fact, the image of the figure who George's mother wants to go to see is the back cover of that
book. I didn't get.
See, sometimes you want the paper book, Ian.
That's a real – and in fact, I've not – that the first time I've seen that. Because in all the reviews – well, because I looked at the book around –
But you didn't wiki the
– I don't even think that's on the trade paperback version.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah. I did wiki the painting, but the painting doesn't have just that
character. No, that's character. True.
So, yeah, I did miss out on that. But anyway, yes, the presence was felt.
Mm.
And I'm pretty sure we went off that topic and I've gone on a ramble. But anyway.
This is it. We have, in a very real sense, read two different books.
Yes.
And we can never unread what we've read, except maybe in 20 years I might have forgotten enough to go back and...
No, we are pure to Ali Smith's experiment.
Yeah, and I did really like that. Because, you know, in a way, like, this is much more explicitly done in this book, but it's the same for any book you read. Everyone is reading a slightly different book because you're not picturing the same things in your head. Picking out the exact emphases. Someone might be really attached to this character. Someone might hate this other character. Someone might find this particular theme a really strong one that might have gone completely over someone else's head and they're more interested in this aspect.
Yep.
So this has been made really explicit by the structure of this book. because
I can't imagine reading it any other way. I think you have to read it the way I read it.
See, I think you have to read it from Joyce's
Francesca
way.
Has to be the start because you have to then pick up the threads of Francesco's feeling through George's story.
See, where I think you need to read George's first because the way I kind of look at it is I'm not sure whether Francesca's part is real, quote-unquote, or whether that whole thing is George's empathy project.
Ah, very, very good. Ah,
so
you're ruining the book for me. Don't do that.
But I don't. I that's a reading that you get from reading George's first because she's emphasised and prioritised to you, and you get all this.
I didn't. That did not occur to me.
And she's talking about writing this project about this artist and having to speak in their words, but you can't really speak in their words because it would be quasi 15th century. And you're like, well, that's kind of how the first part's written. It's written quasi, you know, but it's got so many contemporary bits of vernacular, like, you know, just saying.
Yeah, but that's because they're psychically linked.
I know.
They're psychically linked. It's a fantasy novel. I told you. It should be on the World Fantasy Ballot.
In a way, it's written, I mean, it is literally written. Like, the story of Francesco has literally been written by someone in the 21st century writing about an imagined artist in the 15th century and trying to empathize and view through their eyes and how they would see an iPad.
No.
But it literally has. Like, that's what Ali Smith has done.
Yeah, I know that.
So
you're being very meta.
I'm just wondering if it's and George talks about doing exactly that for her project.
Kirsten, this is clearly a traditional novel that does not deserve a metafictional reading, all right? That's clearly what this is. And you're ruining my reading.
But I don't know if that's what it is. Or do I just think that? Obviously, I just think that because I've read George's first, where you see it as something quite different.
No, I see Francesco as someone who, probably because I come from a genre background as well, that doesn't help. And so then, I come with my own prejudices. I see Francesco as a ghost, a spirit, as something, a force that is linked, whether it's, you know.
And then there's another thing I read in a review, I can't even remember which one, it was just a little throwaway line when the reviewer had said something to the effect of they wondered because there's a line in George's story where she talks about this kind of being the thing that her mother would do. Like, what George is wanting is for her mother to come back and her mother's going to send back a ghost. And I'm just wondering, like, is that realised in Francesca's story?
Has her mother come back as
this personification of this artist? And is that why the artist is gendered female?
That's a much more interesting reading than the one you had.
So I don't know.
Whoever that reviewer is, they've got it spot.
No, the gendered is a bit of me. I was just saying that the reviewer thought the ghost was actually George's mother.
But
I'm wondering if it.
See, that's what's brilliant about this book. See, it's quite obviously, I was joking before about that metafictional tradition.
Because the ghost is very much attached to George, to George.
Clearly, yeah, I got that.
Yeah.
But this is obviously, I don't want to use the term postmodern, but bugger it, I'm just going to throw it in there. Postmodern book, it's.
But it is postmodern.
Yeah, and it's playing around with modernism.
Postmodern is not a dirty word. Postmodern is simply something questions and undermines the authority.
I'm not saying it's a dirty word. What I'm saying is that people use it as if they know what it means.
They're idiots.
Okay. Well, they use it incorrectly, I should say. Incorrect usage of the term. Anyway, but this is a postmodern book.
Yeah.
But rather than trying to strive to be profound, it just tells a human story and a very good one, but just in a fuckingly smart way. And that's the stuff that we're doing now, these multiple readings, is just.
Because, well, see,
but you have to read it with a friend, quite obviously.
See, as much as I quite like the idea of Francesca's story being an empathy, like George's project, I don't know that it is because. Well, if it is, then what it also is George imagining this fresco painter, but also observing herself in a very clear, empathetic way, because the fresco painter is observing George and making observations. If this was George's project, she'd be doing it about herself. So I don't think it
is. There's intimacies in the Francesco story. Mm. That George could not possibly have known.
You can imagine.
No, but they're mature type intimacy.
Is what I'm saying.
There's a maturity to it.
And this is it. This is why I'm saying
the descriptions of George herself, but Francesco's own relationships with others around her.
But don't forget, I mean, it's also about, I mean, I think George is very mature. By the end of George's story, she's done a lot of thinking and a lot of reevaluating of the people around her. She reevaluates her father and her relationship with him and the relationship he had with her mother. She has negotiated a very mature adult accord with her counselor. She's looking at her new friend Hate. That's opened her up to different ways of thinking about people.
True.
I think by the end of George's story, capable of writing the Francesca section, except I'm not sure that she would have that much empathy for herself.
Yes, in terms of the way
the Francesca section is so much an observation of George as much as it is about the painter.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting that you could read it on that way, that this is George's empathy project and here's what she's able to do. And of course she would link it to herself because that's the way it is her life. But it might also be her mother.
Or it could just be a ghost who just happens to be haunting her artwork.
Because it's been summoned by...
Well,
that's something. I mean, if the ghost was going to come back and haunt the artwork, they'd be in Italy, right? The ghost is haunting George.
Yeah, fair point.
So why? Like, even in the sense of this book, this is not just a book about George and a book about Francesca. No, they are inextricably linked.
No, that's yes.
And the ghost itself doesn't even know why it's linked to George. And says several times, like, I have no idea why I'm following this girl. I can't look away. In fact, the ghost is always behind her.
Yeah, look, you're right. I just don't want to read it as the Empathy Project. I just don't want to do that. I don't want to read it that way.
No, I think it's more complicated than that.
No, I know it is. And I know, and in fact, the whole point of the novel is that it could, as I just said before, it elicits multiple readings. Mm. But I just don't want to think of a world that exists where the empathy reading is not just the correct reading, but a possible reading, which obviously it is.
It
has to be, obviously. But I don't want it to be, though. Don't you get it? I just love the book I read.
That's fine. No one can take that away from you.
I'm pretty sure you've done a pretty good job of trying to do that. I'm pretty sure you've.
So how do you bring the ghost and George together?
No, I think there's from a psychic perspective that there's she's got such strong emotions when she looks at that fresco because of her mother's death, etc. Mm-hmm. That it just calls up, it summons essentially the painter, because the painter's on her mind as well. It's not just her mother and not just the art. It's the painter is top of mind as well. And it just summons it up. That's how I saw it. It's just a psychic pull. It's a yes. It's science fictional, fantastical terms, and Ali Smith may not think that way herself, but that's how I saw it. It's okay. It's not as layered and as interesting as yours.
No, but this is what is interesting about the approach. You're giving me this look like,
little Ian, he's
No, because I haven't read the book you've read, so I'm really interested in how you present the book you've read opposed to the book I've read.
I come back to the simultaneous experiences going on here. I come back to the fact that she at that point is having this is George is having these major emotions go through her, and so powerful and so overwhelming that yes, they've caused this anomaly to occur, and these two people to be joined at the hip for a period of time.
Okay.
Okay, I know it's a genre type explanation.
Yeah,
when we read a book, we bring
everything we read to as well.
Yes, and I wanted to say, a crack in the spiritual world and start making it as if it was, the Hellgate or something. But,
well, there's something. I mean, the ghost relates a very physical experience of being drawn out of the literal ground.
Yeah. Well, that's all that fractured stuff. Yeah.
So that it's very much embodied in a way.
And that's why I question, why is that even there? If George is writing it, I suppose George is imagining what it would be like to be pulled into the...
Yeah,
but,
See,
So this is the problem. Every explanation or every response I come with, you can go, but George just...
But why does something have to be right?
No, it doesn't.
I mean, this is the thing. You've read your book. I've read my book.
And that's the point of the postmodern experiment.
They can be equally
There isn't one
weighted.
Interpretation. No, that is why this book is astonishing, essentially. It's why it's one of my favourite books of 2014. But it needs to be read with a friend. I think you almost do.
Which is a beautiful way of thinking about reading, isn't it?
Yeah.
And again, we do this all the time anyway. We read exactly the same book, and we also have we have discussions all the time about the different way we read it, like with Station 11.
Yeah.
Like we had just as argumentative a discussion, I think, about our interpretations of that book, which we read in exactly the same page order.
Correct.
So this book just makes that very explicit.
It's funny. We're not arguing here. We're just I just become insecure about my reading because yours sounds so
But you read a different book.
I know.
Like you literally read a different book.
I completely didn't see your reading because I couldn't – because I wasn't geared to do it because of the way I read the book.
It's,
look, if we're stumbling, listeners, it's because this is this book sort of
– I find it quite fascinating.
Creates that.
It's funny, like I was getting – my stuff together to come here last night, and my husband actually looked at the book I'd put on and he went, oh, How to Be Both. He goes, oh, what's both? And I like, just stumbled around for 5 minutes trying to explain.
Well, no, but is that easy?
What, both? Because it's so
because
many
it's
things.
How to be male and female.
It's
how to
so
be
so many things. Like it's
how to be, you know, alive and dead in a sense. You know, the simultaneous
But it sounds so trite, doesn't it? It sounds so trite when you say, well, you know, it's how to be alive and dead and it's how to live with the past and the present and it's and it just sounds so trite.
But it's the perfect title though.
Yeah. You know, and so I ended up saying, oh, it's just a book about doubling. Go away, leave me alone. Because you try to explain it because it is, as you say, it is about so many things. To nutshell it, it just sounds like really, you know, it's about life and death and grief and happiness, and it's about, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it just sounds terrible.
You're right, but my final word based on that is when people tell you that literature is just a lot of wank and a lot of middle class people bemoaning their lives, that they need to understand is that you can have a genius postmodern book that's also fucking entertaining.
And accessible. And readable.
Enjoy. Except for the people who'd read the, obviously, Francesca bit and couldn't get past the first page.
Well, I guess if you just open it up in a bookshop and read the first page, you go, oh, I'm fucking out of here. It's possibly not a book for you anyway.
Oh, bookshop owner going, yeah, Ali Smith's done it again. I lost another customer.
So hang on, wait, try this one. It's the same cover, just try this one. I swear it's magic. You know, the other thing, and again, as with ribbons in books, probably physical impracticality, I would have really loved for this book to have been like a flip book. And with, you know, as with Elisa did with Above Below, with like no, I like flap copy on both sides, the same cover like on both sides,
read
from.
But that makes it a little bit more obvious that that's exactly what it's trying to do. I actually like the fact that it doesn't. Even though the there's a little instruction at the start, even that you don't have to accept.
That's not in obviously that's not in the printed book.
Oh, okay.
If you got this printed book and you didn't know, you would have no idea there was another version of the book out there.
And I like that.
Yeah, I kind of like it too.
If they start playing around,
I kind of do like the choice.
The marketers may have discussed that. They may have said we should do it backwards and forwards and all this, you know, that thing. I mean, and above David Eggers is one of his first novels. Yeah. That's the same sort of thing. But no, I like that it looks like a novel. In fact, that's the other thing. It looks like a novel, but it's not. It's two novellas.
No, it's a novel in two parts.
It's two novellas.
It's a novel in two parts.
Okay. Or it's a novel in one part happening at the same time.
There's that.
Except they're not really happening at the same
time. They're not, because temporally they are out of sync.
Yes.
So they're not. It's not like you get George's story. And the ghost has been there the whole time.
Here's the thing. The rub. Go buy the both books we've spoken about today, because actually they both play similar games. Because you can get Sourdough and Bitterwood and read them in any order. Slightly different.
Oh, yeah, Sourdough and Bitterwood. Yes, about so. I don't think you can read Bitterwood. I don't think you can chop up Bitterwood. I think it works very well in the order that the stories have been set in.
No, I don't mean the actual book. I mean the two books, Sourdough
and Bitterwood, yes.
I don't mean chop up the Bitterwood book. What I'm saying is go buy these books. They are
– Plus Sourdough.
They are both remarkable and fantastic.
They are. They are really, really good books.
But
and
don't feel the need to buy Ali's because she's won 10,000 quid from the Goldsmith Prize. And
what should they do? Should they steal it? Buy a fucking book if you can, or borrow it from a library. I'm sure this book, probably not Bitterwood, unfortunately, but I'm sure this book is available from many, 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 many libraries everywhere.
And it's an award winner. That's actually deserving of awards.
Controversial.
Da, 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 da. So, Kirsten, now that we're moving on, do we have any feedback? Well, we do. We had a lot on Twitter, but do we have any actual...
We had some written feedback.
Oh, that's lovely.
As I said, we did have a person who thanked us for recommending the Bitterwood Bible. And they also said, I thought I'd read you this part because it was funny.
Okay. I'm hearing.
They said, in terms of reviews, it's usually Ian that gets me yelling at the podcast.
What?
Yeah. The way he seems to always get the details of the books wrong drives me nuts. Totally right. That was Lindsay. Thank you, Lindsay.
What? Yeah. What do I?
You do.
Who's the one who said the pirate story's got no connection to any of the other stories in Bitterwood, and who corrected her and said, yes, there's the tentacle monster? Who did?
And we also got this other feedback from Chris.
Chris who?
I don't think we need to give last names on the podcast.
Well, thanks, Lindsay, first off. Thanks.
Yeah, so thank you, Lindsay. So Chris says, I've just emerged from 5 days lost in the world of Healed. What a fabulous book. Thanked us very much for the recommendation and discussion, and said that for some reason Hild reminded me of Barbara Tuchman's stunning A Distant Mirror, The Calamitous 14th Century, a narrative history in inverted commas. Maybe it was the way both authors interweave remarkable historical research with compelling storylines. And he recommends Tuchman's book if we have a good week or two to spare, he says. So,
what, it's long, is it?
Well, it's a history. So A Distant Mirror, The Calamitous 14th Century, a narrative history. So that would be good. And finally, hooray, we're back. So thank you for Chris. And thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you, Lindsay. And I've got to get back on those emails because I would have responded to that. And
I have no idea why you're not getting the email, because I checked and it's meant to be forwarding to you.
We will have a talk about that. But the point is, if I get the details wrong, it's because I'm...
You've read a million books.
Yes, that's the reason. And I apologise because used to be a podcast I used to listen to, which I won't mention, where one of them...
I do it all the time.
No, but got the details wrong and it used to drive me crazy too.
And sometimes they just forget and you're yelling at the podcast going, it's this, forgetting that it's not a two-way thing.
Yeah.
But it is if you send feedback.
Correct. Or if you're Ali Smith and you write a book that actually has that effect, a two-way effect.
But still not feedback to Ali Smith though.
Yeah.
Like, we can yell at Ali Smith and she won't hear us through her book.
I agree.
Couldn't it be awesome if you could, though?
You will be able to. There's no doubt there'll be a point where there'll be...
No, that would be horrible.
For authors, yes. Yes.
Imagine just you going through your day, washing up the dishes, and this little voice just in your ears going, fucking hated your book. It's like, whoa. Forgot to turn off the Google alerts.
Anywho, what are we recommending for April or Passover?
So what are you recommending?
I'm recommending a new book that I haven't read. Oh, my God, I'm doing a U. But it's been getting very good reviews, and he's a nice bloke.
Okay.
According to all reports. And that is James Bradley's Clade.
Clade, which I'm looking forward to reading. So thank you for recommending it. And on that note, it is also going to be featured on the First Tuesday Book Club.
Oh, really?
The ABC. I think it would have to be in March because we would have already had the February.
I would like James to tell us post-April, because you'll have seen them both, which was a better experience for him. Not because I don't think he's not going to be on the first.
I don't think he won't be on it.
No, of course he won't. No, I'm saying better experience than who provided the better critique.
I would like him to tell me. It's not a competition.
It's always a competition.
Oh, you're terrible.
And what's your book?
Well, it's funnily enough, I'm also recommending a book I haven't read.
We're getting bad, aren't we?
No, I am just my reading time outside of PhD stuff is quite curtailed, and I am using it to read books that I have wanted to read.
It does make for more unpredictable podcasts.
Me read them.
It does make for unpredictable podcasts where, who knows, we could just be ranting about a book.
Well, this book is not just randomly ripped off my to-be-read shelf. This book actually comes via a recommendation from a friend.
But not a listener of the podcast.
Yes, she is. She is a listener of the podcast. And she would like to hear what I think of it. And I thought, well, I might do that as a podcast book and kill two birds.
Okay.
So I am recommending The Well by Elizabeth Jolly, which is an Australian, classic Australian work of Gothic fiction with a capital G, which I have been meaning to read for the longest time. So I'm very much looking forward to that.
So we're Australia-ironing it.
We're Australian. We're reading Australian books. Not saying that made up word you made up.
Well, I thought it was a very good made up word.
So yes, and books we haven't, neither of us have read.
No,
this doesn't James, always work out well.
James, who knows what could happen, mate? You may not want to listen to the episode. And Elizabeth Jolly, she's still alive?
She passed away in a few years ago.
So probably tasteless.
This century, but not.
Tasteless, but I hope she got a better obituary than Colleen McCulloch.
I could look that up.
Oh, there you go. Homework for the next podcast. All right, well, those are the books.
So please send feedback if you would like to. You can comment at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com. You can email us at writerandcritic@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter, where we are writerandcritic, and you'll usually get Ian there.
And I could just say that we are getting quite a few followers. Thank you very much for the people who have actually followed us. I don't know any of you, but thanks.
And also, Ian would like you to know that he would very much like you to leave us a ratings on iTunes if you love us.
I would like to say about that. Listening to other podcasts by more famous people like Mike Pesca's The Gist, which is a great podcast, and the Gimlet podcasts, Reply All, and there's the other one, the Startup.
Startup. I like Startup.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Anyway, they talk about the algorithm that iTunes uses, that when you do give a 5-star, it actually boosts you up on the
Of course.
On the charts.
Of course.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
What's the point of them unless they do something?
Okay, obviously for us, we would have to reach a critical mass of more than 5, you know, or 6, probably 500. But still, you know, feel free. Everyone, if every single one of our listeners did it, you never know. We might be in the top 25,000 podcasts.
Are there 25,000 podcasts?
There's millions.
No.
There's got to be.
Millions of podcasts.
I don't know what the number is. But
it wouldn't be millions. I might be wrong.
How many self-published novels are there? There is as many
There's
podcasts.
Many of those.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but that's a lot easier to do than a podcast. Well, no, it's not. I'm going to just
get. No, you shouldn't get rid of this. This is gold. Comedy gold. Bye.
It's belly.
I'm done.
Belly copper.
That's genius. You can't get rid of it now. Bye-bye.
Bye, Ian.
That's Siri listening to.
We've just been interrupted by Siri, who would like to talk about traditionalist fiction. Turn off your iPhone. That's hilarious.
You going to keep that in the podcast?
No.
Okay.